So I am very fascinated by the possibility that these neurodegenerative diseases are age-acquired autoimmune conditions. And if that's true, then it's an exciting time because we might be able to repurpose some drugs and maybe just think differently, right? Think outside the brain to be able to benefit the brain.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your host from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Eamon Quigley.
My name is Eamon Quigley, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce another edition of the ISAP podcast series on science, microbes, and health. This is actually episode 47. In this particular series of podcasts, we are dealing with the whole issue of the microbiome gut-brain axis. And today I'm delighted to be joined by two scientists who work particularly in relation to interactions between the gut microbiota, bacterial metabolites, inflammation, and Parkinson's disease. And I should say at the outset that even though I'm a clinical gastroenterologist, I've had a long-standing interest in gut function in Parkinson's disease. So our first guest today is Malu Tanzi, who is the Norman and Susan Fixell Chair in Neuroscience and Neurology and former Director of the Center for Translation Research in Neurodegenerative Disease at the University of Florida. Our lab focuses on the role of inflammation and immune system responses in brain health and neurodegenerative disease, with particular focus on central peripheral neuroimmune crosstalk and the gut-brain axis, with the long-term goal of developing better therapies to prevent and or delay these diseases. She will shortly be moving to the Stark Neuroscience Research Institute at Indiana University, Indianapolis, as the first director of neuroimmunology research and executive associate director of education at the Stark NRI. Congratulations, Malu. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Eamon. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by Andrea Marshak, who's a Gator Neuroscholar Postdoctoral Associate at the University of Florida, and her current work explores the relationship between gut health and genetic predispositions for neurodegeneration, which has also received recognition for her work on probiotics and other interventions, including diet, in these diseases. So I'm going to start, Malu, with you and kind of give us a general overview of where you think we are with the role of the microbiome in Parkinson's disease.
Great question. Thank you for asking. I would say that there had now been over 24 studies documenting the imbalance of the gut microbiome or dysbiosis. What we don't know is, was it a result of the Parkinson's or did it predispose and cause the pathology that later showed up in the brain? So that is one burning question. The second burning question is there an opportunity to intervene and fix it? And from that, I think we are lucky enough to be able to take a page out of the playbook of some of the other chronic inflammatory diseases that have been successful in leveraging the role of the immune system, which is in, you know, great communication with the gut microbiome, to beat cancer and to control autoimmune disease. So I am very fascinated by the possibility that these neurodegenerative diseases are age-acquired autoimmune conditions. And if that's true, then it's an exciting time because we might be able to repurpose some drugs and maybe just think differently, right? Think outside the brain to be able to benefit the brain.
As I said at the outset, I'm a clinical gastroenterologist. And of course, from my point of view, everything starts in the gut.
Yes.
You'll both be very well aware of the BRAC hypothesis, which suggests that Parkinson's disease actually originates in the gut and through some ascending process, which may be mediated by the vagus, we don't know, it ends up in the dorsal motor nucleus of the vagus and that area and then results in changes in the substantia nigra, et cetera. Do you think that from the point of view of the microbiome gut-brain axis, that hypothesis is plausible?
Do. I think that the hypothesis is based on, as you know, staining of synuclein in biopsy tissue, which suggests a pattern of, you know, ascending pathology that potentially makes you think that maybe it's something is spreading from the peripheral organs, maybe not just the gut, but maybe the appendix, through the anatomical connections that the enteroendocrine cells that line your gut have with the enteric ganglia. And so the connection, the highway, I like to call it the BRCA highway, is there. And as you said, it may very well be through the vagus, because there are some epidemiological studies suggesting that people who have vagotomies as a group have lower incidence of Parkinson's.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's really critical is that we know that by changing the gut microbiome, you're able to change the inflammatory milieu of the organ, right, of the gut. And that may be a way to modulate how much synuclein you are getting, because it's very responsive to inflammation. In fact, many people think it's because it's playing an immune role, maybe, you know, bactericidal role. And so any inflammation tends to trigger its levels, and maybe that's why it misfolds and misbehaves.
Well, I'm going to get back to this quality of inflammation, because I know it's a big interest of yours. But before I do so, I want to bring Andrea in here, because I know you're interested in genetic predisposition, and a lot of these chronic disease that we all talk about, we love to say, well, it's an interaction between the environment, genetics, and other things, and we don't know what the other things are. In this case, perhaps an interaction between the microbiome, genetics, and the immune response. So would you like to tell us a little bit about the genetic factors that might be at play here and that might be predisposing certain individuals to Parkinson's disease?
Sure. And this also brings up a whole other kind of idea of all of these factors coming together and interacting in a way that can produce this, you know, age-related neurodegeneration. So there's several different genetic mutations that can increase an individual's risk factor for developing age-related dementias and Parkinson's. But realistically, most people who develop these neurodegeneration don't have those genetic mutations. And so there is probably different etiology for different subgroups of patients. We also know that some patients develop it in response to environmental exposures, toxicants. So it might be that some of these genetic predispositions, and what I'm looking at, really involve this heightening of the inflammatory response, which then predispose you to having, you know, damage in your neurons. But it might be completely different for other patients. And so that's another piece of this, of trying to figure out, you know, maybe there does need to be personalized treatment for patients who are developing these disorders because of different sources.
Now, you make a very interesting point there, which reminds me of the fact that, you know, if you take inflammatory bowel disease, for example, which I know a little bit more about, we've learned a lot from rather unusual variants of inflammatory bowel disease, such as very early onset inflammatory bowel disease, where the genetic factors are much more important. And I guess my question to you would be, are there particular genetic markers that mutations that have provided particular insights into mechanisms that might be relevant in Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's or other areas of neurodegeneration?
Yeah, absolutely. So one that we are particularly interested in is the LRRK2 gene, in which there are several different mutations that have been identified in patients. And we have not necessarily identified the main role that it's playing, but we have reason to believe, and a lot of data to support, that it's actually changing the inflammatory environment, especially as we age. And so people who have this LRRK2 mutation tend to, as they age, have a dampened immune response.
They need a reboot and they are getting, you know, exhausted. You've probably heard that discussed in the context of cancer, right? T-cell exhaustion. And again, it's uncanny how some of the similarities of immune dysfunction may be very relevant. They're just playing a slightly different role later in life. But we think that, as Andrea pointed out, that these processes start probably in your 30s, right? That's when the body starts going in reverse. You've passed on your genes, you know, that's all she wrote. And so because we've been so good at handling and treating cardiovascular disease and cancer, we're all living longer. And immune cell exhaustion is a topic that my lab and others have been very interested in. And of course, Andrea's, you know, big question is this something we can modulate potentially with, you know, probiotics and prebiotics?
So I want to get back to you again, Manuel, just to take up on what Andrew just said. You know, I don't know whether you like the term or not, but people use the term inflammaging. And, you know, this really very much ties in with what both of you are saying. Like, could you set the stage for us in terms of what's going on as people age in terms of inflammation in the brain, inflammation in the gut, and how they may interact?
Yes, of course. So a couple of years ago, we were fortunate enough to be asked to write a review for Nature Review Immunology, which I can, you know, refer you to for more details. And in there, we talked about the inflammatory manifestations in Parkinson's and where they begin and the hypotheses that are still, you know, the burning questions. So inflammaging is a term that some people actually think is a typo when they run across it. And it actually was coined by several people who have been studying, you know, immunosenescence and inflammaging, which is a double-headed monster. So what you get with inflammaging, and most of this is coming from Goranzi lab at Stanford. They've studied the human immune system and the aging of the human immune system, you know, very, very in depth. The idea is that you have kind of an inflammatory syndrome where you end up with B cells and T cells, right? Your adaptive immune cells that are less responsive to the stimuli in their environment. They're also less diverse. And that contraction of diversity and decreased sensitivity to stimuli couples with a different change in the ratio of your myeloid to lymphoid cells. So now you have a lot more innate immune cells, which are, remember, the first line of defense, right? But they're not as good at memory as the adaptive immune system. There is an innate memory now that's emerging, but that's not what they were, you know, evolved to do. And so what ends up happening is between this increased in myeloid cells that are mostly cranking out inflammatory cytokines, you get this low-level, low-grade inflammation. And that's the hallmark of inflammaging. It's characterized by increases in interleukin-6, tumor necrosis factor. And in fact, there are some really interesting studies where if people look at the levels of IL-6 in your plasma, it is directly related to how fast you walk. So fast walkers have low IL-6 and slow walkers have high IL-6. And maybe that's a little bit interrelated with, you know, the pain involved in, you know, your body, your muscles, your feet. But that's an interesting correlation for me. So it's a low grade inflammatory syndrome. And at the same time, the immune system has aged, has become less competent, right? And it stops recognizing self. And that should sound all sorts of alarms in our head if we're thinking about neurodegenerative disease, because these are proteinopathies more than likely. And if the immune system can't recognize self, then it's going to have a hard time deciding what is debris and what should be left alone. And that's where we think the inappropriate pruning of synapses comes that contributes to dementia. And that's also where we think the hoarder's episode starts in your brain, because the vacuum cleaners, your innate immune cells, your microglia did not do their job and prevent the garbage from accumulating.
And at least the accumulation of alpha-synuclein or amyloid, depending on the disease state.
That's right. And there's a lot of others, TDP-43, tau, they're all co-aggregated in these plaques or, you know, aggregates. And it depends on where they form in the brain that they end up affecting, you know, different circuits. And you end up with, you know, say, dementia with Lewy bodies versus Alzheimer's versus Parkinson's.
So, of course, we want to talk about the microbiome. We want to talk about probiotics and prebiotics. And you've beautifully illustrated what's happening as we age with regard to inflammation and how that may lead to predisposition to neurodegenerative diseases, etc. What's happening at the same time with the microbiome? We know that there are, we don't have a lot of data, but we do know there are changes in the microbiome as you age with disappearance of some important commensal taxa. And both of you, and maybe Andrew, you want to jump in first, how might this be playing a role in terms of the inflammation that ultimately ends up in the central nervous system?
So the bugs that are in our gut, whether that's bacteria or viruses or fungi, all interact with our immune systems. So the gut is actually, as you're probably familiar with, one of the main immune hubs of the body because it's where we interface with the environment so much. And so that's where we get a lot of our education of what is safe, what is self, and what is actually danger and what could potentially be a pathogen. And so a lot of the immune education happens there. And so that can happen through direct interaction between somehow a bacteria. It makes it through the gut barrier and directly interacts with an immune cell. But more often than not, it actually is coming from pieces of dead bacteria, metabolites, things that they are producing that crosses our gut barrier and then can go into our circulatory system, and from there is able to interact with our immune cells through lymphoid organs and the such. So that is the primary way that we're seeing that communication. And what's especially interesting is that a lot of these metabolites can actually cross the blood-brain barrier and influence the inflammatory state of, for example, the microglia of the brain, which are some of the primary immune cells of the brain. So between that and direct communication, and we know that if the vagus nerve can influence how ramped up the immune response becomes, which we know has direct connections with the gut, there's a lot of different methods.
Yes, you're talking about the vagus as an anti-inflammatory mediator, you know, Kevin Tracy's work. And of course, there is a blood-brain barrier in the gut as well, which is very interesting. And of course, we've got microglia in the gut as well. So, and I guess maybe I'd go back to one of you, and to which one you want to take this. But so how much can gut pathology tell us about brain pathology in either of these diseases?
Yeah, so that's kind of a hard one when you're talking about which system is influencing which. And it's the chicken or the egg always. Are we developing changes in our microbiome because of changes in the rest of our body? Or are these changes happening first in the gut? And frankly, it's a two-way street. And so teasing that apart is kind of the work that we're doing now.
That's exactly right. It's an interesting, you know, whodunit. It's interesting that you said you're a gastroenterologist, so, you know, the gut is very important. I sometimes like to...
The most important organ.
I like to say that the brain is an extension of the gut.
Exactly. We're plants immediately.
No, scientists don't like that. But, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. Some of the work that Andrea and others in the lab are doing is suggesting that we might have a window into the brain through the microbiome, through the blood, and through colonic biopsies. So we've been fortunate enough to be funded by the Parkinson's Foundation and the Michael J. Fox and the NIH to look at what is going on in the colonic biopsies of individuals with Parkinson's, normal neurological controls, and inflammatory bowel disease in individuals. And we coupled with a gastroenterologist who you might know, Chris Forsmark, here at University of Florida. And he was fantastic. So he did sigmoidoscopies on all our subjects. And Andrea and Mac Bolin and others in the lab did metagenomics on the stool. They looked at the blood in the PBMCs. We looked at bioenergetics, and they looked at how the blood cells might be reflecting changes in the brain. And one of the most important things that we found, and this is part of it is on bioarchives already, and it's being submitted for peer review, what we found is that you actually have iron mishandling in the gut. And we've been talking about iron and iron deposits in the brain of Parkinson's for a long time. And so it may be that this is a way that we can see what's going on in the brain. Maybe it's happening earlier in the gut than it is in the brain. And the only reason I bring that up is because we've known that individuals with IBD also have iron issues. Some of them are anemic. And when we compare them to the Parkinson's subjects, there are a lot of similarities. And two things that stand out are the iron mishandling and the depletion of short-chain fatty acids, specifically butyrate and propionic acid. So a hypothesis may be that the reason that individuals with IBD have predisposition for Parkinson's is because they're walking down that road of that chronic inflammation being a trigger for synuclein increase and synuclein misfolding. And maybe that's the population that we need to intervene in to slow it and prevent the further progression along that BRCA highway. So gastroenterologists need to talk more to neurologists.
Well, we all talk all the time. No, so we're beginning to come towards the end of this wonderful conversation, which, as far as I'm concerned, could go on all day. But we need to talk about interventions. Now, I know we don't have an awful lot of data here in human studies, but you know, there are people with Parkinson's disease who are giving themselves fecal microbiota transplants, totally uncontrolled data. And of course, there are studies looking at probiotics and prebiotics. And Andrea, I'd like to give you your summary of where we are with microbiome-modulating therapies in this particular area.
Yeah, the anecdotal evidence around fecal microbiota transfer is really interesting, and I'm really excited to see kind of some controlled studies done down the line. But beyond that, you know, a pretty significant intervention, we talk a lot about probiotics, prebiotics, and diet.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to talk about one of them without it being within the context of another. If you take a probiotic pill, they will last for a couple hours, maybe in your system, and then will be flushed through if you do not have the appropriate, you know, food to feed the bacteria that you're ingesting. And so I think that a lot of the work that's being done right now is figuring out better ways to administer them for long-term use, especially for age-related disorders, where presumably you'd have to take them for a long time to promote healthy aging. And then figuring out the interaction between these gut microbes and the diet itself. So there are several different diets that are being tested that are almost prescribed diets. A lot of them are focused around high fiber diets, healthy fats, and things like that. And there's been a good amount of success with healthy aging in populations that are at high risk for neurodegeneration. So while we don't have any magic bullet microbiome intervention right now, I do think that the combination of both diet and probiotics in the future could be something that we look to for most people and as a preventative agent as we begin to age.
Well, I'm delighted you started with diet, because it's usually the part that's forgotten. And as you know, while, you know, on the web, they've been talking about an anti-inflammatory diet for years, there's now beginning to be more evidence that actually such a thing exists. And in the inflammatory bowel disease area, there is more and more interest in diets which may suppress or reduce inflammation. And Jim Lewis and Penn has done some very nice studies in that area. So there is some real progress there. How about probiotics? Do you think there is evidence yet, or are we still at a fairly early stage in terms of looking at that as an intervention in these disorders?
Yeah, we're still at a very early stage when thinking about probiotics. I think that evidence is just starting to mount in a very convincing way for disorders like mood disorders or autoimmune disorders. I did a lot of work in multiple sclerosis, where there does seem to be a ton of evidence suggesting that this is going to be a really good intervention. When we think about these age-related neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, related dementias, it becomes more fuzzy. And a lot of the clinical trials that have been done have been very short-term. And so I don't feel like we've adequately tested them in a way that gives them the best chance for success. It's going to take a lot of resources, a lot of patient involvement to get to that point. But I do think there's hope that this could be something successful on the horizon.
Well, I think you beautifully summarized the challenges that we all face in these studies across all chronic diseases, but particularly what we're thinking about today. So, Malu, I want to come back to you and get back to something you said right at the outset. And that's, again, something that confronts us and challenges us with all these association studies in humans, and that is chicken and egg. You know, where do you think we are in incriminating the microbiome as a causative factor in, say, Parkinson's disease or in Alzheimer's, rather than being perhaps a secondary factor? Do you think the balance is tilting towards a more causative role or not?
Well, I would say that because we have the privilege of being able to work with animal models, they help us with causality. And there have been several studies coming out of the Massmanian lab and others showing that the microbiome and, you know, fecal microbiota transplants, if you will, from individuals with Parkinson's have the ability to accelerate a genetic predisposition that you've put in a mouse by putting human synuclein in there. And if that's true, then that directly links something in the Parkinson's stool and microbiome to the ability to seed and accelerate that process. And that's really exciting because, as you know, one of the newest things that has come online is this seeding assay that's being done in Parkinson's to see the earliest manifestation of synuclein misfolding. And so what about getting your biopsy at colonic biopsy, you know, colonoscopy at 50, and making sure that you don't have synuclein increases in your enteroendocrine cells and in the lamina propria, you know, immune cells that are chewing it up. And so that would be one way to dovetail with the blood test for synuclein seeding, which right now is mostly being done in the CSF, but I'm very hopeful that it will be translated to the blood. And also, as you know, they're doing it in the skin. And so that's another barrier site where it's possible that because of some exposure that your skin barrier has sensed, synuclein has increased in its levels and in its aggregating. So I'm very hopeful that we will be able to establish causality by doing the animal models, but also working with populations that don't yet have motor or cognitive symptoms and are in the prodromal stage, right? So the anosmics, REM behavior disorder, the MCI population, the memory forgetters. So that's, I think, where the immunomodulation and intervention may be most effective.
So do we have enough data at the moment from human studies, this is to either one of you, to be able to predict exactly what you're describing? Could a microbiome snapshot today in a 30-year-old predict an individual who's going to develop Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, say 20 or 30 years down the road?
Yeah, that's super bold. And while I would like to say yes, we're not there yet.
Right.
But if I were to look at a microbiome that had depletion in short-chain fatty acid producing bacteria, reduced, you know, propionic acid and butyrate, increases in, say, ferritin in a biopsy, signs of inflammation, I would definitely feel confident in saying that Parkinson's and dementias are gene by environment interactions, and your genetic predisposition is what it is, and you can't change your genetics. But the environmental piece that is making your gut inflamed is something you can probably modify. And so it's an opportunity, right? It's the glass half full for me, instead of half empty.
Fantastic. Well, I would like to thank both of you for a fantastic conversation. We will be following your work, whether in Indiana or in Florida, with enormous interest. And we look forward to further exciting developments. Thank you very much, Andrea, for being with us. And thank you very much, Malu, and every success with your future work. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. Check the show notes for links and further information on this topic. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to this podcast so you never miss a new episode.